take one last look in that television set, because in 10 seconds, I'm going to be gone. And ask yourself, what on God's green earth is causing all this?
Woo! From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Discretionary viewer participation is advised for the following professional wrestling exhibition.
Due to the coronavirus pandemic, Greetings from Allentown is not taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 163 of Greetings from Allentown. I am your host, Peter Winston. And today, well, I was looking for something to revive my flagging interest in professional wrestling of late. Don't worry, this is something that happens at this time of year, well, every year for the last six, except for last year, because I actually went to WrestleMania, where, everything just seems like too much, and I'm kind of just over it. So I thought, okay, well, let's pick a promotion in a year that's definitely going to do it, even if it was one that I've done in the last 10 episodes. And sure enough, Jim Crockett Promotions from 1986, I would hope would do the trick. This is NWA Worldwide from April 5, 1986. And this is the week after a show that I did, like 2.5 years ago, one of my favorite angles ever, maybe my favorite thing that I've ever covered on this show, Jimmy Valiant getting his ponytail cut off by Pez Watley, who snapped and joined Paul Jones's army, seemingly out of nowhere. So I figure the crowds are hot, so maybe I will come along for the ride a little bit. I said that I feel this way every single year. It seems like last year being the exception, because I actually went to WrestleMania in New Jersey, and it was just kind of a different feeling. Like there's just so much of it. And I'll get into how I felt watching the empty arena WrestleMania. I watched a chunk of the Saturday show and all of the Sunday show, and I do have some strong opinions about certain things that happened on that. But before I get into that, why don't I get in my place? You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. That is @GFAllentownPod. And you may be listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And you may have seen on social media, on Twitter, that WorldCast has returned earlier this week. Welcome back to the feed, guys. You were sorely, sorely missed. And I look forward to following World Class in 1984 along with those guys. I also, earlier in the week, not on PWO, but on my own feed, the Greetings from Allentown feed, I did do a second edition of Greetings from Allentown, or GFA Live, with my pal Keithy, the voice of Greetings from Allentown, on AWA from September 10th, 1985, that had some truly horrible video quality. And we just went off, and you go off on a bunch of various topics, such as Greg Gagne reminding me of Greg Brady, and a long extended thing about The Godfather and how a lot of that movie you could translate very well to the mid-1980s interpromotional wrestling wars, when you put Vince in as Michael and Vince Sr. as Vito. And, well, we cast a number of the characters. And I'm thinking, just one more, and maybe I'll bring this up the next time I do a podcast with Keith, or if this whole topic comes up. I would cast Dr. D. David Schultz as Carlo, just because he got in trouble for slapping somebody around. So I feel like there's a lot of parallels. And it's certainly, I don't think it would stop there. I mean, if we really think about that whole universe, we could cast everybody from professional wrestling at that time. When I was thinking about a show to do this week, I needed to get away from WWE, WWF for a little while. And I do, as I'm taping this, it is Monday night, and I do have the Raw, which, by the way, least obnoxious post-Mania Raw crowd ever. thankfully. Well, with the exception of 1993, because they taped the post-Mania Raw before Mania. It was at the Manhattan Center. So that was a little different. I was thinking a Crockett show from either 85, 86, 87, or 88, and to do it in the month of April. Because, I don't know, I just felt like staying in the same month. And it came down to the first edition of NWA Main Event from 1988, which I managed to find, and I watched a little bit of it. The only thing that really stood out for me, I mean, yeah, it's Dusty Rhodes versus Ivan Koloff on that one, but Ric Flair's sweater that he wears during the Horseman promo is cracking me up because there's like a lot of pastels in it. I'm like, wait a minute, are you Slick Rick, the world champion, or are you going over trying to bone Blanche Devereaux or something? And I don't know, I couldn't find an 87 Crockett show that was to my liking, so I stumbled upon this, which wasn't even in my queue, probably because I had done the show from the week before. Now, you're probably thinking, oh, you just chose 1986 because you've been watching all the 1986 Celtics games on YouTube and have basically turned your civilian Twitter account, not the podcast one, but my civilian Twitter account into a Larry Bird Celtics stan account where I just have like these 10 tweet threads commenting on game 2 against the Bulls from the 86 playoffs. And I would say, yeah, it pretty much has come to that at this point, except now I'm through the 86 playoffs and I'm already on to 87. I watched most of the Chicago series today. You realize that the Chicago Bulls, Michael Jordan Bulls, never beat Larry Bird Celtics in a playoff game? I know that the Celtics had a distinct advantage for the entire time and they never faced the Bulls after Pippen or Horace Grant got to Chicago, but it was 6-0, and in fact, the Celtics swept the Bulls in 1981 also. So Larry was a perfect 10-0 against the Chicago Bulls in the playoffs, but they play in 87 as well. Very different series, Chicago and Boston. It's pretty close because it's closer than you might think because the Celtics are so banged up, but should be an interesting playoff run to see, except for the fact that the Milwaukee series in the second round, only 3 out of the 7 games are available in full on YouTube, which kind of makes me sad. But then I realized that the same thing with the Milwaukee series in 86, there was a couple of games missing, and that was all that I couldn't see, so I just had to watch highlight packages of it. And yes, I am trying to put together hockey games, because this quarantine, now in its fourth week, I may have to start watching hockey games again at some point, but if I have to watch that sport, it's going to make me sad thinking of the fact that, oh yeah, that's right, how much money did I spend on tickets for this regular season that is probably not going to have a playoffs, and my team is first in the NHL in points, and the whole thing is going to be for nothing? I mean, that's quite frankly going to bum me out as somebody who loves having season tickets for the journey through a regular season. I see it like a wrestling storyline almost, except, you know, most of the time you don't know exactly where it's going to go. So if I get to the point where I start watching hockey games on YouTube, then we're going to have a problem. Because that means this thing will probably get 6 months. But just in case, you know, I put the Bruins Avalanche game from 1998 on there. Like, I'm not going to put too much in stuff of games that I was at. But, you know, I'll do that. And if I were to watch baseball, I would probably watch it at 1.25 times speed. Because I can't sit there for 3 hours and 35 minutes and watch that Orioles-Blue Jays series from 2015 again. I just can't do it. I mean, I'm just so bummed out that there's no sports in the month of April. So I remember a couple of months ago, I was on Place to Be Nation's The Great Debate, hosted by Andy Atherton, and one of the questions was, what is the best month for sports? And of course, for a lot of people, it comes down to October versus April. And I'm on Team April, and putting aside WrestleMania and all the burnout that seems to cause for me in other years other than last year, you have NHL and NBA playoffs start in the month of April. You have baseball, well, I guess they now start in March, but in April is when things are generally getting underway, and you have teams that still have hope. I mean, the Orioles were, I think, 4-1 after 5 games last year. I mean, couldn't give up all hope at that point, right? The Masters in early April, which apparently is going to be in mid-November, which is just going to be really, really strange to see, where the NFL, the Masters is going to be played in the morning up through the afternoon, and then CBS will cut to the NFL at 4 o'clock. It's just going to be a complete mind screw if it comes off like that, if our society puts itself back together. And then, of course, the Final Four, NCAA. I mean, just think, this past weekend, I'm taping this on Monday night. Who knows? Boston University could have become the first 16 seed to make the Final Four in the national championship game. I mean, we will never know. All I know is that we had a good chance because one of our best players for BU is named Walter White. And it's not the same spelling, because White is spelled with a Y in his case, which amused me when I found that out. So as for the WrestleMania 36 show, which I know they don't use the number anymore, but which is just beyond bizarre. I mean, it's like, yes, using the number has hurt the Super Bowl so much that clearly nobody watches it anymore because the Patriots weren't in it. And that clearly now we have to have a WrestleMania pirate flag when they might even just go back to Tampa in a couple of years. Personally, for WrestleMania 38, because apparently the LA thing is going to happen, and fine, but I'm giving my full and complete Fred McGriff, Tom Emanski endorsement to the city of Minneapolis, because it meets all of the peak criteria for WrestleMania. Number one, it's got a dome stadium and it's downtown, so that's good, because you know you don't have to get a car to go everywhere. I mean, you can Uber quickly around the city if you really want. Number two, lots of direct flights, multiple airlines with direct flights from Boston to Minneapolis, so Delta, JetBlue, all the good airlines. So I'm happy with that. And then finally, you know, I like the city, and they have a very good beer scene. They have good restaurants, enough restaurants that from when I went there in 2018 that I know I can go back to and I can count on them and that they are going to deliver. But as for the card, I did not watch probably the first two-thirds of the card on Saturday, and I have not gone back and watched it. Yes, I know, I told you, Keithy, via text, I was going to go back and watch Daniel Bryan versus Sami Zayn, but I haven't gotten around to it yet, because I'm burned out. I just don't feel like doing it. And you may see me as something of a traditional fan, and I am. I mean, I'm looking at 1986 Jim Crockett Promotions, so it kind of, this definitely speaks to me. However, when I saw the Boneyard match on Saturday night with AJ Styles and The Undertaker, I, for one, am quite frankly sick of sitting through crappy Undertaker matches the last 4 or 5 years because he just cannot move around the way that he did. And I know that this is apparently very much a ripoff of the Matt Hardy Final Deletion stuff from TNA or Impact. Great, grand, wonderful. But the way it was put together, and I have to admit, it may have been helped by the fact that I was on a live chat with a bunch of people that I like and respect, and I did have it on mute, but I kind of want to go back and watch it with the sound on, because I enjoyed it just as much, I guess, with the sound off, because it was shot in a very cinematic way. And I liked it. And it hid a lot of the annoying Undertaker flaws that just make me groan in these matches that he's had the last few years. Like none of this Undertaker Goldberg stuff from Saudi Arabia, where he can't just he can't hack it anymore. And neither can Goldberg, because, well, okay, I'll go right to night two. Anybody else notice that Braun Strowman and Goldberg's matches, Braun Strowman, Goldberg, and then the Lesnar match were almost the exact same thing, where you had Goldberg and Lesnar dominant early, the other guy gets in no offense, and then the other guy hits his finisher a couple of times, and it's all over. I'm like, okay, well, clearly, they have no use for Brock at this point, so we got to put the title on the 3MB guy. I mean, it worked so well with Jinder Mahal back in 2017. By the way, being serious, I don't think he was that terrible as the champion. But then again, I don't think I was really watching weekly TV that much. I was kind of dipping in and out. So it's easier to like something if you're not overexposing yourself to it. I mean, who knows? I mean, they did not exactly follow up with him very much, because I can't think of a single thing that he has done since then that comes to mind. So Drew McIntyre, whose thing was kind of ruined by not having a crowd behind him because he had certainly started to build momentum. And Braun Strowman beating Goldberg, it was because you knew Goldberg wasn't going to be there more than a couple of times a year at most. And Roman pulls out of the show for very justified reasons, I might add. Although I wish that Roman, rather than the coronavirus stuff, which was, as I said, 100% justified, given his health situation, if Roman Reigns had said, I don't want to be on the same show as the Firefly Funhouse match because I know what you guys have planned, and I don't want to be anywhere near that Bray Wyatt stink that, I mean, give me a break with that crap. Because you bring back John Cena for the first time in over a year. I don't even think he had a match in the year 2019. And he's barely even referenced. We're kind of moving on without him. And you drag him back from the movies to do this. You waste John Cena on this. And it had me thinking, it had me going to some dark places. Maybe not quite as dark as the whole let's choke Edge on gym equipment spot from the Last Man Standing match, which was 37 minutes long. It may have run a little long, but I certainly have more of a problem with the Wyatt match because Bray Wyatt is involved and he is friggin' horrible. It made me wish that, wish being the operative word here, because John Cena has done so much for Make-A-Wish over the years, that if I was a Make-A-Wish kid, let's say I'm born in a different era, or if time travel was possible, my wish would be to meet John Cena in advance of 2019, and I would just implore him to not do this match to make sure that it does not exist. And anybody who likes that, it was all freaking self-reverential crap where they're just jacking themselves off. I mean, give me a freaking break. What the hell was that even supposed to be? Oh, it's this you know, postmodern history of WWE and their booking and their love of muscle. No, everything Bray Wyatt touches dies. Have we not learned this from 6 years of watching this guy? Everything he does, and I'm speaking as somebody with the stupid haunted house match he had with Randy Orton. Now, I didn't really mind it at the time. A lot of people hated it at the time, and I kind of defended it on this podcast, and I regret doing it because defending anything Bray Wyatt does just ensures the absolute destruction of professional wrestling. I had a hard time. I know I'm starting to sound like Cornette here, but my God, I mean, I had a hard time even like getting up the energy to do this podcast. I took my notes for this show before the Firefly Funhouse match. And then when I saw that, I said, why am I even doing this? Like, why am I even addressing this sport, entertainment thing, whatever the hell you want to call it, when they're going to put something like that on their best show of the year? I don't care how much under duress they might be with, we can't have more than X number of people around and all that. I mean, they probably should not have run the damn show in the first place, but I understand why they did it is because they are scared shitless about losing TV money from this, since it's pretty much their only source of revenue. And they're a TV company now. They're not a live event company at this point. They lose money when they do live events, unless, you know, certain TVs. But the money they get from USA and Fox, that's what drives them. So that's why they're doing these empty arena shows every single week. Anyway, I should really just get my mind off that because it just pisses me off so much. And I've drank a lot of beer in the past week. And support your local brewery, as I said last time. And this week I went to Medusa Brewing down in Hudson, Massachusetts, where I pretty much I went, you know, you order online and then you get the contact-free delivery or whatever the catchword is for that. And I pretty much pulled the Ron Swanson from Parks and Rec, except instead of eggs, I was ordering IPAs.
Just give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Wait, wait. I worry what you just heard was, give me a lot of bacon and eggs. What I said was, Give me all the bacon and eggs you have. Do you understand?
It can be difficult keeping yourself up and feeling normal during these very abnormal times. So, you know, just focus on your passions. I mean, I guess for me, it's drinking a lot of local beer, which might not be the most healthy thing. So if you're sober, if you're off alcohol, I mean, certainly there are other passions out there. You might like cheese. If your local cheesemonger is still open, you know, throw some business their way. Or anything that's out there, especially if it's a small business, because, you know, we're all in this together. I don't mean to sound like a politician, but what the hell can I really say at this point? I mean, we've been locked in my house now for nearly a month with no sports, and I'm just contenting myself with the Larry Bird Celtics of the 1980s. By the way, Larry, very quiet in the first two games of the Chicago series in 87. And I don't want to go too far into that. I'm probably going to be more basketball coming up organically. Hey, maybe even as soon as the break, before I get into this show, which has a Flair, Arn, and Tully six-man at the end, which, granted, it's against Jobbers to the Stars. That's the correct pronunciation. It's a six-man team entirely made up of that. So that's something to like. I mean, it's like having a Dangerous Alliance six-man in early 92. You know you're going to get something good out of those guys. Shaska Watley is in action 1 week after cutting the hair of Jimmy Valiant. And I can't wait to talk about him again. And we got Wahoo, we got Jimmy Garvin, they're in a feud with each other. Hector Guerrero is on the show for some reason. I'm not sure what I'm going to come up with to say about him. Ron Garvin is here, and this is important because, well, it's a Ron Garvin and Wahoo, so it's a Stiff the Jobber night, and David Crockett on commentary. You know he's going to be excited, or at least I'm expecting him to be positively orgasmic, because this is a Jim Crockett promotion show from 1986 with those two guys. And Magnum TA is in action, but don't blink because you might miss the entire bout if you do that, because it is rather brief. So without any further ado, why don't I just get right into the show? NWA Worldwide, April 5, 1986.
The Sixers should try to have a set play to see who he can tip it to. He should try to tip it to Julius Erving if he can get the tip up high.
3 seconds left. Out to Doctor. He's got a crack at it. Three-pointer. He got it!
Let's explain the situation there. It's the 1986 Celtics going into Philadelphia. On this weekend in 1986, there's a jump ball for some reason with 3 seconds left at the foul line. It gets tapped to Dr. J, who hits this miracle fall-away three from like 25 feet to beat the Celtics, one of only 15 losses that entire season. And I got to tip my hat to the good doctor who went to UMass Amherst, where he played his college ball there. I just have more respect for like NBA legends versus like maybe not baseball, but especially like hockey, because I'll have it out for any great player in the league because they've probably done something that's deeply offended me personally. But in the NBA, and maybe this is as a result of Kobe dying a couple of months ago, but you know, I think of those guys like Dr. J. Much respect to him, except for the fact that in November of 84, when he and Barkley, a rookie Barkley, and Moses Malone decided to try to lay a horseman-style beatdown on Larry Bird, with Moses and Barkley holding him in the triple team for Dr. J to throw a straight right. I don't approve of that at all, but other than that, I certainly appreciate Dr. J. Now, speaking of gangs who are roving around in 86, we got the Russians, and this is in the cold open to NWA Worldwide. Ivan and Nikita Koloff, as is only proper. We don't have Khrushchev there because Barry Darso is nursing a knee injury. And they're beating the cramp out of Rocky King with a chain, which is pretty bad optics considering this is an African-American man. But at least this isn't like some fat white Southern sheriff. So I guess maybe it's like a little speck better. I don't know. But Magnum TA runs in for the save, and we go right into the funky theme for NWA Worldwide, which I played at the top of the show. And when they go through and they show all the guys on screen, I swear to God, I think Dusty Rhodes is going to, like, do the Travolta dance from Saturday Night Fever and, like, spin around. I don't know if it's, like, the jacket that he's wearing in that photo or what it is. So our hosts are, as mentioned earlier, Tony Schiavone and David Crockett. And the Crockett Cup is coming up in April. That is the big story in the NWA. It's going to be down in New Orleans, a two-night affair, which they put on the WWE Network under Hidden Gems, one of the last things that they put on there. That might have been about a year ago that they threw that up there. I have not watched it to date, and it's got nothing to do with my recent malaise about wrestling. It's just that I never found time for it, and maybe I could fire myself up enough to watch that. And we're all talking about Pez. No, not the candy, not the dispensers that were so popular. Of course, we are talking about the great Pezzavon Watley. Yes, Pez was short for Pezzavon. And damn straight, too, because we get Paul Jones's, well, group comes out. And I've referred to them as an army, and I swore that they were referred to as such well before this. And they come into frame. We get Pez, who's now going to be known as Shaska Watley, and Paul Jones, number one, Paul Jones, and Baron Von Raschke, who's doing that thing where he holds his wrists with the freaking claw and just looks like a complete maniac. Like, he looks so goofy at the same time. And I posted this on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod the other day, and just taking the screen cap of this, like, this is pro wrestling personified, as David Crockett is just kind of, you know, like trying to get the microphone in so that they can say something. So while this might not be the start of Paul Jones's army per se, it does lend a lot of credence to my theory, which I went into in great detail, about Pez Watley being the victim of a mind control programming scheme by said army.
From now on, everything I will do will be done in a military fashion. My army is completed. I have the Baron from Germany, the Barbarian, Tejo Khan. Let me tell you something, Jimmy Valiant. What has happened to you so far has been done in a military fashion. I infiltrated your side of the fence, your army. And I was talking to my men in the barracks the other day, and I said, welcome, Pistol Pez Watley, the new addition. My army is complete.
And it seems clear to me that his military operation in turning Pez was such a success that he's decided to double down on that going forward. I mean, really, this is the best analysis that I've ever done on professional wrestling, so that's why I just never pipe down about it. And also because it's so damn enjoyable. I mean, I'm the only person who seems to be explaining the fact that he's carrying a scissors for that reason, because he was programmed by Paul Jones's army. So Pez, who's still not being referred to as Shaska quite yet, apparently. Apparently, there's a disconnect between Worldwide and World Championship Wrestling, which there was from time to time. But Pez, he's kind of like Patty Hearst in 74, where all of a sudden he's captured by this group and he's now a completely new human being.
Thank you, now, boss. I want to tell you, Jimmy Valiant, I got your number. I got the main prize right here, and we're going to do it to you. We're going to do it to you. And it's just now starting. I want you to understand that we together can destroy you.
This is a feud where if I was watching the footage as a younger man, say 20 years ago in the midst of the Attitude Era, I would have been like, oh, this is just complete bullcrap, and I don't enjoy this at all. But now, it's so brilliant, because anytime you need to freshen up this Jimmy Valiant versus Paul Jones's army thing, you just turn another one of Jimmy's friends, and it just creates this entire new thing. Because a couple months down the road, you're going to have Manny Fernandez finally accepting the money from Paul Jones's army, and he flips over. That's how you could keep a feud going for 3 years and have it still be fresh the entire time. So Sharp Dressed Man by ZZ Top starts playing in the arena, and Jimmy Garvin, gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, is on his way out to take on Ben Alexander, although you wouldn't know who that was because he doesn't get a formal introduction. And of course, he is accompanied by Precious where the gimmick is she is spraying the area with some sort of fragrance, it would seem. But I'm starting to wonder now, and maybe this is just seeing it through quarantined 2020 eyes, is perhaps a can of Lysol or some kind of Clorox spray would have been good. I mean, maybe you could bring that back now. Although, since they're doing it in empty arenas, you could still do it in an empty arena. I mean, to basically be like some germaphobe gimmick where a dude's got like a bunch of, he's hoarding Clorox wipes, and he comes to the ring, and he basically loses focus on the match because he feels like he has to disinfect everything or stop to wash his hands. Like, yes, Iron Mike Sharp was like that in real life, but I'm talking like bring it to the screen, something like that. We could even, like I said, with the hoarding, we could maybe explore that issue as well. He's got a lot of toilet paper, maybe dealing it in the locker room. I don't know, but one thing that is refreshing with Jimmy Garvin and Precious is it's so refreshing to see them making out in the ring very quickly before the match. I mean, they've been a couple since the 1960s. I mean, you think about pro wrestling couples, like the marriage survival rate on those, it's not very good. And they've gone over 50 years, which, I don't know, I have to say I'm mildly touched by that. The crowd is oddly mixed reaction for Jimmy Garvin, which I find strange because he's very clearly a heel and they're still very much adhering to kayfabe, but you could hear a lot of cheers for Jimmy. And I think some of it might be that women find him attractive. Now, I don't get it at all, but it was 1986, and the standards of the day were very different. Like, just like I called that woman 80s hot a few weeks ago who was on All-American. Some rights, a clothesline, and a vertical suplex that did not at all look like his brainbuster that he would ordinarily do, but they call it that anyway. Like I guess he was just not in the mood, Jimmy, to be taking any chances and dump the guy on his head, and that is how he picks up the victory. His whole gimmick, apparently, is, oh, I don't want to face Wahoo, and I'm somehow feuding with him at the same time, but eventually, at some point, you are going to. Now, the week before on Worldwide, Garvin had done a promo where, oddly enough, very much like Gene Okerlund on All American Wrestling, where he would pretend to be talking on the phone to various celebrities. Jimmy Garvin was pretending that he was calling Wahoo, and Wahoo was crying and begging off, saying that he did not ever want to have a match with him. So, you got to get a reminder every so often that just because Jimmy Garvin was not good in the Freebirds from 90 to 92, and I don't even know if I should count that weird 1994 one-off appearance he made against Johnny B. Badd. In fact, I'm not going to, but this guy in the 80s, world class 83 and into 84, and this little run here, he turns babyface in early 87, pretty good.
And let's go to David Crockett. Ladies and gentlemen, we have the World Heavyweight Champion with us today. But the man that has his number, Ron Garvin, we have him.
If the making out between Jimmy Garvin and Precious made you uncomfortable, here's Ronnie Garvin with David Crockett, which might make you equally uncomfortable, but maybe in a little different ways. And by the way, Garvin is with Masters Champion David Crockett. I should say that because he is wearing the green jacket. I don't remember David Crockett winning the Masters, but apparently he did at some point. So he has Ric Flair's number, Ronnie Garvin does. At least in the first quarter of 1986, they're doing a lot of time limit draws, which, by the way, wrestled to a 60-minute draw against Ric Flair is one of those things like every biography of a journalist who's over the age of, let's say, 50 will include covered the fall of the Berlin Wall, because, that was a thing that happened. Or covered 9/11, I guess, would be the more modern version of that. So I guess, Garvin is taking Flair to the limit, but he's losing in some of these matches. They ran some cage matches in various cities as well. Of course, we know the story. Eventually, he's going to win the world title, but that's not going to be until near the end of 1987. And I covered that one in the archives last July 2019. I don't know what episode number it was, Crockett. I just can't remember. So Garvin has an interesting sort of philosophy I mean, Ric Flair calls himself the dirtiest player in the game. I mean, that was a phrase that he used for a very long time. So Garvin's approach is very much in line with that, where he's going to fight fire with fire.
And like I said before, you know, a lot of people have been telling me my mistake was that I don't know how to cheat. Cheating when you get in the ring with Ric Flair seems to be the key. Well, you know, cheating, lying, and doing those things, you know, to me, it makes you a criminal. So Ric Flair is a criminal. The world's champion is a criminal because lying, cheating, and doing all that stuff is illegal. Well, if it takes that, Ric Flair, I might just resort to death, if that's what it takes.
Certainly a different perspective, having the babyface just go on out there. I'm like, maybe I should just start cheating. Kind of reminds me one of the great Jesse Ventura commentary moments at WrestleMania 4, which I know nobody really likes except for a few people, and I think I'm one of them, but it's mainly because of the commentary for that one match. I think it was, yeah, Steamboat versus Valentine, where Jesse Ventura says, I don't think he should try to go hold for hold with Steamboat. I think he should cheat.
I don't think the Hammer should try to match up hold for hold with Steamboat. I think he definitely should cheat.
I guess sometimes in life you have to give as much as you get. I guess that applies to love and that Beatles song, or even in cheating in pro wrestling and dirty tactics. Like, if Garvin's not alone in feuding with Ric Flair, because Dusty and Flair, that's always kind of lurking in the background, but Dusty liked to work with Tully Blanchard too, so who's going to wrestle Ric Flair during this time? Well, it's going to be Ronnie Garvin a little bit in the first quarter, but then as you get into the second quarter of 1986, a very different sort of opponent for Flair in the form of Ricky Morton, one half of the Rock and Roll Express. And you kind of scratch your head like, aren't the Rock and Rolls red hot as a tag team at this time and like just incredibly over, one of the most over tag teams ever at any point at that time in 1986? Like, well, yes, they were. And I listened to Between the Sheets recently where they were talking about this week in 1986, and the theory was floated, and maybe it's even more than a theory, that Dusty put Morton out there to cool off the Rock and Roll Express. I'm not entirely sure why he would necessarily do that, because the way I see it is it's kind of a worthwhile flyer you're taking, where let's see how Ricky Morton does in a singles feud with Ric Flair. I mean, you can justify it on the basis of him being one half of the top tag team, and just kind of see what Ricky Morton does with it. I mean, if you might end up with another great singles babyface out of this. I'm sorry, Robert Gibson, but you know that's just the way the cookie crumbles sometimes. But I can see both points of view, the Dusty as diabolical, trying to keep a guy down, but also Dusty, the creative guy, trying to, you know, take a flyer on something. So on the Saturday show, Flair had confronted Ricky Morton about the differences in the women that they go out with. Flair was known for the the over 18 crowd, and he seems to be accusing Ricky Morton of being with girls in training bras, which feels like a real dig, like he's saying that he's hanging with underage girls. That might be crossing a line.
As you know oh so very well, I am probably the finest connoisseur of beautiful women. I'm talking about women with full sweaters, you know, the big girls. So one of my big girls the other day asked me to give you this. And she said, tell Ricky Morton, if you may, to give this to one of his little teeny boppers. So, whew, how about that, sport? In other words, I like the big girls, and you like the little teeny ones.
You know, you're about a considerate fool. I mean, you come out here, brother, you talk about all the things that you've got and what you're going to do. But it wasn't too long ago, Ric Flair, all these nice people right here stood behind you and made you what you are today. Now, without these people out here, you're nothing and I'm nothing.
Are you trying to tell me that when your name is Ric Flair and you're the world champion, that you got to have a whole building full of people to carry on? Wherever I go, I don't care if they love me or hate me, because I love myself and I know that I'm the best there is.
Morton takes the sunglasses off Flair's face, which, I don't know, might be a gesture of, hey, dude, you're inside and you're not Rod Trongard. I mean, you don't have to wear sunglasses inside. I mean, you don't have big bags around your eyes. Although, who knows? Flair might have been hungover with it being one of those Saturday morning tapings at Techwood. That's why he would take offense. Well, that and the fact that Ricky Morton stomped on the glasses as well. So he kind of started this. I mean, it's not like, well, except for the whole you like to screw underage girls bit, I don't think Flair was entirely in the wrong with this. But they brawl into the ring, and Flair, he does not get the upper hand on this at all, as Morton is kind of dominating him. And David Crockett, he's just as excited about this as he is your average Ronnie Garvin or Wahoo squash match.
Ricky got him! Over the top rope! He put him over! Woo! Love it! Ricky Morton has Ric Flair suplex! Oh, not on the mat! He did him! Did him in!
David Crockett has some flaws as an announcer, but I'm willing to overlook them because sometimes his enthusiasm was infectious and not annoying. I mean, Brad Stutz had pointed this out on Twitter, at Stutzy, a couple of days ago, how the little shriek there where his voice cracks. That sounds like it could be like an ambulance siren in a third world country. Like how the ambulance siren in France and the United States is very, very different. Maybe this could be the one in like Zimbabwe or something. Like David Crockett just shrieking about Ricky Morton beating up Ric Flair. Now, Garvin says his piece a little bit. I've heard enough from him. So he ends up in the Crockett Cup, teaming with Magnum TA. Not a bad guy to be tagging with at that point in time. And they were seeded number two, and as expected by such a seeding, they went to the finals but lost to the top-seeded Road Warriors. And Magnum TA, the other half of that tag team, is here in the interview area. And he's the U.S. champion. And as we saw in the cold open, he saved Rocky King from those Russians beating him up with the chain. And Magnum, he's had it up to here with these pinko commies.
Well, I think by this time, all the people out there know how sick and tired I am of the Koloffs, particularly Nikita Koloff. Now, they made a whole lot of accusations about America, a whole lot of accusations about the United States heavyweight champion, Magnum TA, and a whole lot of demands. Well, I'm turning all that around on them. I think we got a film clip coming up here going to show exactly that actions speak a lot louder than words. Nikita Koloff, now I'm taking it to you.
So now we get to see the video of what happened after Magnum made the save. He dispatches Ivan, gets him out of the way, and then takes on Nikita and proceeds to hang him with a chain over the top rope. Some pretty vicious stuff, but certainly badass, and the kind of thing that, yeah, if a babyface does it, it seems out of character, but it's the people are going to accept it, especially when it's a no-good pinko commie Soviet. I wonder if Ronald Reagan at that time, because I'm thinking that Magnum is kind of carrying out Reagan's anti-communist policies, well, except for the fact that he's assisting a black man in the process. That really does not fall in with Reagan's policies. But I don't know. I just had it pop into my mind. Did Ronald Reagan know wrestling was a work? And I'm really just sort of pondering that to myself. And I think the answer is yes, just because he was in movies and probably understood. I don't know why the hell I'm thinking of that. It's probably because I'm thinking about anything but wrestling at this point. But yeah, hang in, Nikita. I love how Nikita sees the light 6 months after this when Magnum has his car wreck. But we go back to Magnum in the interview area, and holy crap, this is fired up babyface promo. I was going to say 101, but I don't think this is the intro course. I think this is some postgraduate stuff.
I think a picture's worth a thousand words. Nikita Koloff, I had to feel that chain around your neck. I had to feel it get dragged all over that ring. You want me in a Russian chain match? I don't really think you do. The next time you look at me, you realize this. They called you the Russian nightmare. Well, Magnum TA for you, it's a reality. I'm your nightmare, and I'll take you all in pieces in your kind of match. This will stay mine as long as I got any breath left in my body.
That was so great, but I was kind of expecting Magnum to ask people to start calling him the American Nightmare, in contrast to Nikita being the Russian Nightmare. And also, he teams up with the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes, which makes sense for a Rob Zombie song several years later. I've been looking for a reason to cram that song in somehow over the past month, month and a half, since I downloaded it off Amazon, because I heard it on Sirius, and I was like, I feel like I've heard this before, but I don't know where, but I'm going to need to download it, because I need to listen to it several dozen times. And as it turns out, it is the opening theme to the Howard Stern Show. I really don't listen to Stern at 7 in the morning, so it's just, I don't catch the beginning of that show. It's like Die Hard 3. When it's on TV, I never actually see the beginning of it, but whatever part I pick it up at, well, then I'm just going to watch it through to the end. So why don't we just go right into the next match, which is David Crockett's hero, Ron Garvin. Maybe you could caddy for him at the Masters at some point, taking on Ron Rossi. Now, Ron Rossi, I just did a quick research, like as I do with all the enhancement talents, to see, you know, what I could find about him. And there's another guy named Ron Rossi who's probably comparable age. I wouldn't say same year, but, you know, within 6 or 7 years, you know, he could have passed for the other Ron Rossi, who finished 9th in doubles men's luge at the 1984 Sarajevo Winter Games. double men's luge. Now, that's basically like the open sled that you're going down on. Maybe that's bad terminology there. Doubles men's luge. I mean, just take a look at how that works. Like, just go put that in your Google machine, as Conrad would say. Men's doubles luge. Oh, my goodness gracious. So, it's David Crockett calling a Ronnie Garvin match. And clearly, Garvin's going to be not going to disappoint. He's just going to beat the hell out of Rossi early. Some clubbering, vertical suplex, the double stomp. We don't get the full Garvin stomp very much in Crockett. In fact, he does it in the Flair match in September of 87, where he wins the world title. But it's not like you see him laying that out to the enhancement talents like he did to Frenchie Martin at WrestleMania 5, which, I don't know, a lot of people think that's the best thing that Ronnie Garvin did in the WWF, was get Frenchie Martin written off for a long period of time. Honestly, though, I still like that submission match with Valentine, because it was an NWA match in the middle of the WWF show, which is something that I absolutely adore. An Irish whip and a backdrop. And I gotta say, I don't know if David Crockett's just on his best behavior because he was just at Augusta National and got that green jacket on and all, but he seems a little subdued. My operating theory on this is that David Crockett knows that Wahoo McDaniel is coming up a little bit later in the show. He hits just as hard as Garvin. He needs to leave a little bit in reserve for Wahoo. Plus, he might need a little bit more oomph at this time in his career, winding down in JCP, his last full calendar year in the promotion. So why don't we just go right to the interview area, where the national champion, the national title, it always feels like a weird way to say it. It's like you have a national title and a U.S. title. Luckily, the national title will get phased out by the end of the year. It's Tully Blanchard and J.J. Dillon. And he won this title on the March 15th episode of NWA Worldwide, which I'd be more than happy to do at some point. The problem is, the Crockett stuff is just harder to come by. It's like, I see this on YouTube, and I'm like, okay, this is perfectly fine with me, but I got to do it right away, or I got to download it, and with my laptop the way that it is, as I talked about on GFA Live number 2, for God's sakes, I feel like I can't download anything on there. Now, Tully, forever an arrogant prick, and I gotta say, I don't know how much he's been on AEW lately. Kind of a mistake putting him with freaking Shitney Spears. I mean, give me a break. Would it have made way more sense if just have him and MJF as like a package deal together? I mean, MJF's feuding with a Rhodes, for God's sakes. And Tully's, like, Tully's big feud was with Dusty. Dusty's feud with Tully is more consequential to me, looking back, than his feud with Flair. Just because I feel like there was more fire to the whole thing. But Tully, he makes a good point about Ronnie Garvin that I purposely am overlooking.
Wasn't that the most legal move you've ever seen in professional wrestling in your life?
Oh,
right,
you
there?
About
one big punch. David Crockett, just stay there and be quiet. The big cup is coming. Double A and myself, 2 weeks from a Saturday night to Superdome New Orleans. Hot diggity darn, $1 million in that beautiful cup. We may have to cut it in half, one for each of us to take home with us. But you know, everybody knows the top teams, how great the tournament is, the magnitude and the money involved, that everybody is going to be given 190% to get the job done. But only the team with the greatest mind and the greatest endurance to go out there and wrestle 4-5 times to get the job done is going to come out on top. But Dusty Rhodes, I got something for you. You want to talk about being the greatest there is? Bite snakes' heads off, everything, and you can do it all. 2 times World Heavyweight Champion. But who took you down? What does that make me? I'm the one that took you down. James J., give me some more time. I don't want to be wound up by none of these. Who's he? Give me some more time.
Gotta go to the ring.
Give me some more time.
Now we'll go to the ring.
Again, I'm starting to have flashbacks to freshman football and the athletic director telling us 150% and saying it like 5 times in his speech. 190%. What a weird amount to use. But, you know, that's a classic Tully heel move. 190%. Just, you know, give completely unrealistic percentages for that sort of thing. Now, I wondered, with the Crockett Cup coming up, was this the first time that Tully and Arn teamed together? Because, well, you say, well, no, you're crazy, because they clearly were allied together prior to this. But a lot of it was in six-mans with Ole, and that's the way they would do things. But no, in fact, the first time that I can find that Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard teamed up together as a two-man unit was actually a house show in Dorton Arena in Raleigh back in April of 85. Tully and Arn defeated Buzz Tyler and Manny Fernandez. So that's a little trivia. So you heard, well, actually, I think I carefully edited it out of the end where you start to hear Mexican music, mariachis, because they just frighten me. I've spoken before of the wedding that I went to in Texas. It was Temple, Texas. Maybe it was Salado. It doesn't really matter. All I know is that we had the reception. It was in a big barn, and some mariachis showed up, which made sense since the groom was of Mexican descent, but apparently they came to the wrong wedding. Now, I'm kind of terrified of mariachis ever since one of them gave me a creepy look at a Mexican restaurant back in 2009, where it looked like he was going to come and kill me in my sleep. So I don't like it when the guy plays the horn doing the chicken dance thing, you know, the da-na-na-na-na-na-na, because I just picture a Mexican guy staring at me. So anyway, Hector Guerrero is up next against Vernon Deaton. Actually, Hector Guerrero has been, I mean, he's not creepy per se, but, you know, Gobbledygooker was pretty creepy in that costume. I mean, just the way it looked was just very, very strange. Now, Hector is your classic undercard guy who doesn't have a lot of big feuds, but he's a name to have on house shows because he's from the famed Guerrero wrestling family. Of course, Eddie hasn't even come along yet, but the Guerrero name carries some cachet at that time. I think of him as kind of like the down market, less pushed version of Tito Santana, but he kind of looks like Eddie Guerrero. So maybe if you just ignore, you know, that his name is Hector, and you just pretend that he's just Eddie without, you know, some of the other qualities that Eddie would bring to the table. Kind of like that stuff that they were talking about earlier, about Ronnie Garvin was talking about cheating. That was when Eddie Guerrero's career really turned that corner into superstardom, the lie, cheat, steal stuff in, I think it was 98, WCW. As Crockett calls him, the best Latin American superstar or wrestler that there is, which I wanted to write that, yes, under contract is what he actually means. And just some mat work to start, and he gets in a leg lock But Vernon Deaton manages to get to the ropes. And I need to make a GIF file of this. I've gotten behind on making videos and this sort of stuff. But he rolls around the ring really fast. And I was like, well, I'm not sure what he's trying to do, if he's just trying to weird out his opponent. Now, it looked faster to me because I was watching it once again at 1.25 times speed, which I cannot recommend enough for certain YouTube viewing. It does speed up the pace for all you modern fans who might be like, they sit in a reverse chin lock or an arm bar for 3 minutes at a time. It's like, yes, this match definitely would have gained a lot had Hector Guerrero done a suicide dive to the outside on Vernon Deaton, you know, after everybody else had done a suicide dive earlier in the show, rendering it completely meaningless. Which, by the way, just gave me the thought of Ronnie Garvin doing a suicide dive, which I really don't want that thought to pop into my head again. I do not like Hector Guerrero's light gray gear, but, you know, what are you going to do? I've done enough griping here, so, I mean, it's not like I can change it. It's not like I can CGI it over to red or the dreaded light blue or however you want to get it. In the Crockett Cup, Hector and Chavo Guerrero lost to the Bushwhackers in the preliminary round. They did not have 16 teams in this. It was kind of an odd number of teams where the top few seeds got byes and you had a preliminary round. Kind of like the NHL playoff format in the 70s. And by the way, don't get me started on that because there's some screwed up things. Like the NHL, one of their most noble traditions is having like a stupid-ass playoff format, which, by the way, when they do come back from this, and they are desperate to do so, I would not be surprised if they did some asinine 24-team playoff, because that's the way the NHL does things. It's like the NBA has had like the same playoff format now since 1984, I think. And it's perfectly fine. It's conference-based. But the NHL, they always tinker with it. And they go back to what people got sick of. And anyway, that's I probably don't need to go on an NHL rant since, you know, they're not even around right now. I mean, they're pretty much dead to all of us. Backdrop, side headlock. Deaton with some strikes that didn't have much effect. And a flying headbutt by Hector off an Irish whip, which I thought was a flying burrito or a flying forearm, but it was actually a headbutt. And then he hits two backbreakers, at which point I feel like he's setting up for a Boston Crab or something. You know, that would make sense. But instead, he hits a regular running splash that is kind of like Twisted Bliss, but on the mat. I know I just complained about the modern product, but it was basically a splash where he does kind of a 180 like Alexa Bliss does. I mean, this is perfectly fine, I guess. I mean, that is what Hector Guerrero is, a guy you have on the undercard on house shows, and it's perfectly fine, and people like him. He's like the Stuart Smalley of, like, Jim Crockett Promotions.
We interrupt this program for this special report from Channel 5 News. Here is Ron Majors.
There is an apparent hostage situation underway at this moment.
Well, I mean, I did compare Pez Watley to Patty Hearst earlier in the show, but this actually is something that came up after I had watched a different video of this show, which did not have commercials and did not have any of the local promos. And I was kind of disappointed. I was like, I really wanted more Pez Watley in my life. And like a gift from heaven, one of the YouTube accounts that I love very much and subscribe to uploaded this same episode of NWA Worldwide, and I'm very grateful for that because, yes, Pez Watley gets to speak his piece.
Sam Houston, you better look out, boy, because you got the same problem Jimmy Valiant got. You ain't nothing but an undercover hillbilly anyway. And I'm going to let you know one other thing, boy. You, my name is Shaska, spelled with a K, sucker.
This run in April of 86 that Watley goes on with these promos, they're all just absolutely delightful. I mean, you don't think of Pez Watley as like having must-see moments in his career, but yeah, check this out. Starting with, you know, the turn and then into, I'd even say go all the way up through the summer of 1986. He eventually gets his head shaved in that feud. But then again, everybody got their head shaved in the Jimmy Valiant versus Paul Jones feud at one point or another. So why don't we just go right to the next match, which is the aforementioned Wahoo McDaniel taking on Mark Fleming. Now, I already talked about how David Crockett loves him some Wahoo, works stiff with the enhancement talents, but, you know, let's try to think of something else to say about this guy. I mean, Wahoo McDaniel, and by the way, it's singular, of course. It's McDaniel. It's not McDaniels like you'd often hear. Unless, of course, it's Vince, where you got to add an S onto the name because to make it yours. But, you know, just a little bit of background on Wahoo, in case you did not know. He was born in Oklahoma. He is actual, authentic Native American, unlike Chief J. Strongbow, who's Italian. But at a very young age, he moved with his family to Midland, Texas, which would be the same place where that girl fell down the well in 87 or 88. I just remember that was a huge deal, being like, well, like who falls down a well? And growing up in Woburn, Mass., where the wells were contaminated with God knows what, it was make sure you don't fall down any wells where I come from. When Wahoo was a kid and playing baseball, George H.W. Bush was his baseball coach. And that's kind of fascinating. Of course, he wouldn't grow up to play baseball. But in the meantime, he was a bit of a wild kid. He was actually known as Wahoo as a child, which I thought was fascinating. This is not something they came up with for his football career or for wrestling. His dad was known as Big Wahoo. When you're called Big Wahoo now, I think that has a completely different connotation. Goes to the University of Oklahoma, plays football. Jim Ross gets a stiffy, I'm sure, even though he was, you know, at a very, very young age. Jim Ross reached puberty at that point, let's say. And his pro career, Wahoo, very popular player in the American Football League, eventually with the New York Jets, although he was with several teams. He played linebacker for the AFL's Houston Oilers and Denver Broncos, but really became a star when he was traded to the New York Jets in 1964. He was a crowd favorite and made 23 tackles in a single game against his former Denver teammates. As a gimmick, whenever McDaniel made a tackle, the PA announcer would announce tackle made by guess who, which the crowd would respond, Wahoo. He was picked by the Miami Dolphins in the expansion draft in 1966 as the team's major name player. During the 1968 season, he knocked out two police officers in an altercation and was traded to the San Diego Chargers. Wahoo never played a game for San Diego and started wrestling full-time. McDaniel was unique in that he wore his nickname Wahoo on his jersey in place of his surname. So, years before the XFL and He Hate Me, Wahoo was doing that, and he pursues the wrestling career. He was wrestling when he was playing football. It's back in the AFL. While the AFL had a positive impact on the salaries of football players, because now you have more teams, the AFL and the NFL, competing for talent, it's not like those guys were making big money. They had to work off-season jobs, selling insurance or whatever, moving furniture. Instead, Wahoo became a pro wrestler, like Red Grange before him back in the 20s. And he was wrestling down in Amarillo, the Funk Brothers, for Vince Sr., even when he was with the Jets, wrestling in the New York territory, which, of course, he never comes back there after the mid-70s. So, like, once he hits his prime, he never works the New York territory after a certain point, unless you're going to say, but didn't he give Tatanka that headdress? Yeah, in 1994, and that really doesn't count. But Mid-Atlantic, Jim Crockett Promotions, that is Wahoo's territory above all. And he was primarily responsible for bringing Ric Flair to the area. So, you know, he's one of the biggest stars there in the 70s, and he brings in their biggest star for the 1980s. Fleming bails after one chop, and I can't say that I blame him, but at the commentary desk, actually, I'm not even sure that they have a desk. I think they're just kind of standing by the backdrop. And they have stools or anything. Not sure, but Precious, the valet of gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, stops by to basically shit-talk Wahoo for a while.
Him how to wrestle. book, and Precious teaches him how to treat a lady. And that's all, about all I've got to say, Mr. Crockett.
Well, I guess that's one way to do the inset promo. They didn't have her record something backstage and then put the little, you know, square up in the corner like you'd ordinarily do it. Instead, she just joins commentary for 30 seconds, and that is that. They did have her live picture in the corner. I just thought it was strange that they did it that way. And plus, Precious isn't exactly much of a talker, but she contributes to the act by the way, you know, she's spraying all the stuff around and sanitizing everything. I can only assume. A reverse chin lock by Wahoo, and apparently he must owe Mark Fleming a favor because he's really taking care of this guy and not, you know, just beating the crap out of him from bell to bell. A slam, and then he sets him up in the corner for the big chops and Irish whip, and the big chop gets a 1, 2, and 3. They go to commercial after the bout, but Wahoo joins them again for a post-match interview in the area in which they would do such things. And I found it a little curious where Wahoo says that he was away. I have to admit, didn't know that he was gone.
You know, a long time ago, I asked Dusty Rhodes to help me. A man dropped everything and came. Now, the man asked me to help him. I didn't exactly drop everything, but I finished up ends, and I'm back here to help Dusty, and I'm back where I belong, right here in the Mid-Atlantic area, because, you know, this is my home, and this is going to be my home. And there's a lot of people sticking their nose in my business, and, you know, there's a lot of people that say they want to fight the legend. Well, you know, a legend is somebody that does a lot of great things. Well, I'm not saying I've done a lot of great things, but I've done a lot of things. And I want to tell you one thing, Jimmy Garvin. Don't send that little girl out here to do your work. If you want me, I did dropped a lot of things. It cost me a lot of money. But I'm here, and Jimmy Garvin, I'm going to tell you one thing. Nothing will make me happier than to get you in that ring.
Wahoo took a little time off in Q1, which was well-deserved because he's 47 years old at that point. He lost in the finals of the TV title tournament to Arn Anderson at the beginning of January, and then he returns at the end of March. And you're probably wondering, why do I keep referring to everything as Q1, Q2? Like, I'm referring to everything by quarters of the year. That definitely has to do with me working in the financial arena. And it's like, okay, I need you to do a data load for Q1, Q2, for Fund 3, whatever, like, but not only that, it's also basketball, where now all I do is think of everything in quarters, because I'm, you know, not to get back on this, but I cannot just watch these 8-minute highlight things of Larry Bird. I need the full context of everything that's going on. And I don't know, I'll tie this back to Wahoo somehow. I mean, he was an athlete and Larry Bird was an athlete, but Larry Bird was a master of when you would double him down in the post, he could always find the man on the weak side. That was one of his strengths. And I'm sure if Wahoo had played basketball, I'm sure he would have figured it out as well.
Boston blasted off right, thanks to Dwight Evans.
We are ready for the first pitch of the 86 season, and here it is. Long drive, left center field. Way back. Gone. Home run, Dwight Evans.
Hey, what a way to start the season.
Remember Dwight Evans hitting a home run on the first pitch of the 86 season being a really big deal at the time because of how unusual it was. Now, it was done by Ian Happ of the Cubs in 2018, but with the way home runs have been watered down since then, I can't put it in the same league as Dwight Evans homering off fraudulent Hall of Famer Jack Morris. After all, that game was at Tiger Stadium, and if there's one stadium, let's just say baseball, one baseball stadium that's been torn down that I wish I could have gone to is definitely Tiger Stadium. Because, I mean, the fact that they tore it down and people have maintained the actual baseball field that was inside since then, I haven't checked in about a year, but I'm sure that that's still the case. It's quite touching, I have to say. I have not been to Detroit for really anything other than the airport. Been to Grand Rapids, but that's a complete other side of the state. I keep wanted to say, you know, go to Detroit, but what the hell's the point now? Because they don't have Major League Baseball, and they might play a freaking season in Arizona. Although, that's not as bad as the Stanley Cup playoffs being held exclusively in North Dakota. I mean, I'm just going to slap my forehead if that thing comes to fruition. So we got Rocky King, who is in the ring, happy and recovered from his chain beating by the Koloffs. And we got Shaska, with a K, coming to the ring with Paul Jones and the Baron, and he's demanding to be called Shaska Watley, as we heard in the interview from the alternate video that I picked up on. I already took all my notes. I'm not going to do the whole back and forth thing, because I did that on one show a long time ago, and I nearly went insane. I cannot do that on a regular basis. Besides, I feel off kilter enough, considering that I can barely leave the house for the last 4 weeks. I mean, I've worked at home now for 17 consecutive days, which I know is probably old hat, and maybe some people out there have worked for more consecutive days, but I kind of would like to be in person so that I can see my coworkers and maybe perhaps learn from them, because it's just easier that way. So I'm very interested to see Shaska here, because when you have the heel turn, you kind of want to see that first match, because they're just going to probably lay it all out there. And he slaps Rocky around a couple times, actually bites him. Backdrop vertical suplex, which I swear has been, I think that's the third time that combo has been done, like back to back on this show. And he chucks Rocky to the outside, as allows Paul Jones to get in a few shots with that weird baton thing that he is carrying around, because it is now an army. And Shaska, I don't want him rising from the dead and coming after me. He's trash talking Rocky as he lays in the right hands, and then a lot of plagiarism going on in this show. He hits the exact same flying headbutt that Hector Guerrero did earlier. Meanwhile, in the booth, Tony Schiavone keeps calling him Shasta, like he's the value brand soda at your local supermarket. By the way, Shasta, also an African female name. And in Sanskrit, it means teacher. So that's, you know, it is what it is. But Tony should stop comparing him to value brand sodas, because let me tell you a little story about my life back when I was living in Las Vegas, and I was not making a lot of money. I was working at Barnes & Noble, and I wasn't even a manager. In fact, I had lost out on a manager position because the store manager there didn't like me, but that's a whole other story for another time. I went to the Smith's supermarket, and realizing that, you know, I was, you know, not doing well in terms of money, and my bank account was getting alarmingly low for the cat that I had, Brady, may she rest in peace, I bought the store brand cat food, and I really, really felt bad about that as I put it in the carriage. And then I went to the soda aisle, and I looked, and I picked up the 3-liter, yes, not the 2-liter, the 3-liter bottle of the store brand, I forget if it was Smith's or the other supermarket there. It doesn't matter. It might have been Albertsons. It doesn't really matter. I had a breakdown in the aisle because I was about to buy store brand soda. And that was when I realized to myself that I needed to make some changes in my life, and eventually led to me moving back to Massachusetts. And it's where I am today, hosting a podcast, talking in my basement about the time that I had a mild breakdown in a supermarket buying value brand soda. So anyway, not unlike Pez Watley, who decided to make a change in his life, between Rocky King and Nighthawk, I gotta say, Shaska, not exactly kind to his fellow African Americans. In case you forgot what happened with Joe Nighthawk Coltrane, as he was known, this is a guy who came in for about 6 to 8 weeks or so, cut some really bad promos, which I highlighted back in episode 42, and he was very concerned about Pez, his friend, because of his sudden turn. And I forget which show this occurred on. Maybe I should do next week's Worldwide and it'll turn up there. And he thought that maybe Pez was in need of some money, but Watley turned him down in the most hilarious way.
Listen, man, what's wrong with you, man? I've been trying to get in touch with you thousand times. You don't want to come? What's your problem, man? You need some help? You need some help? You need some money? Here. I ain't got that much, but I got a little bit. Here, you need some money? Take it. Because you ain't got no business here with these guys, man. They nothing, man.
What?
They ain't nothing, man.
Well, thank you, brother.
I think the lesson that Chaska was trying to impart there, and it's something important for the kids to know, to carry over, that if somebody is offering you money and you're still planning to sucker punch them, please make sure to say thank you. I mean, after all, being polite will probably cause them to put their guard down and it'll make your sucker punch all the more effective. It's very important for the children to know that. Now, this is Jim Crockett Promotions in the 1980s, and it would be absolutely criminal if we didn't hear from Ric Flair with the big gold belt, which he's only had for a few months, replacing the other license plate NWA title that... You know what? I'm starting to like that a little bit more, but I still prefer the big gold belt. It's just so damn iconic. Now, April 5, 1986 is a... I mean, obviously, this was taped beforehand. This is not a live program, but pretty big day for Ric Flair. I'm anxious to see what he has to say.
Wait a minute. Ron Garvin has your number. Ricky Morton
slaps you
around.
As I walk out here...
And Dusty Rhodes
and see all the excitement in the eyes of these women... It occurs to me that if you could bottle this stuff, you wouldn't have to promote wrestling. We'd sell it. We'd both be millionaires. But unfortunately, ladies, there's only one Ric Flair, and I only like four or five women per night. So as you see, I can't work y'all in. Now, Ronnie Garvin, you've told the whole world that when you got a hold of me, this would be yours. Yet, week in and week out, I walk out here to the dismay of David Crockett and to the dismay of a lot of the wrestling fans still able on a very legitimate basis to call myself the world's woo heavyweight wrestling champion. New Orleans, my kind of town, bright lights all night long. And when I get through a Dusty Rhodes, what are you going to say then? What are you going to tell them then, Big Dust? Huh? Ricky Morton, you have made the career mistake. You see, Morton, I was just having a little fun with you, telling you how it is, telling you that little teeny boppers and training underwear don't make the man. You got to walk that aisle in every major arena throughout the country. And I don't care if it's Cincinnati, Greensboro, Chicago, St. Louis, New Orleans, woo, San Antonio, Texas, Richmond, Virginia. When I walk that aisle, the announcer is saying, here comes, ladies and gentlemen, the world heavyweight wrestling champion, the very finest there is. So you see, to sum all this stuff up is whether you like it or not, take one last look in that television set, because in 10 seconds, I'm going to be gone, and ask yourself, what on God's green earth is causing all this? Woo!
I know what you're thinking, having listened to that. Like, what's so special about that? I mean, you talked about boning four or five women at a time, you know, all the time. Saturday show, Worldwide, Pro, no, didn't matter where it was. And why were you saying, Pete, that this was some sort of big day for him? Well, April 5th, 1986 was the day that his daughter Ashley was born. And of course, she would grow up to be Charlotte, who had a pretty fine match with Rhea Ripley on WrestleMania 36. See, I didn't hate the entire show. I mean, no, not by any means. Apparently, Rhea Ripley had to go back to Australia because of a work visa issue, which explains why she would have lost the match. But also because now they can do a rematch next year and have her beat Charlotte. I mean, you know, Charlotte loses every so often, just maybe not as regular as some people want it, but you have to have a dominant figure. That's how wrestling works. That's how wrestling gets built. Hulk Hogan didn't get to be the star that he was by jobbing once a month in the Mid-South Coliseum. Now, I'm not, you know, castigating anything with the way Lawler would do things in Memphis, but to be like, oh, well, the top person should be losing all the time. You're friggin' idiots for thinking that way, which is another reason why I hated that stupid, self-serving Firefly match that was just complete and utter bullcrap. Like, oh yeah, we need more Bray Wyatt. We need Jake Roberts if he was completely uninteresting and had no skill or talent whatsoever. And oh yeah, if he was also as fat as he was in Beyond the Mat, which I guess is on Netflix now. So I should probably watch that. It would probably make me happier about professional wrestling. I mean, you know, if I don't watch the Jake parts, if I just watch the Terry Funk ones, the Mick Foley ones probably wouldn't do that. Magnum TA against Tony Zane is up next. And yes, if you blink, you miss it, because Tony Zane's a bit of a pudgy dude. Really not much to say about him. I don't think he's related to Billy Zane. Just want to apologize for any triggering that might have been done by playing a small clip from the movie Titanic. I mean, after all, I sat through all 4 hours or whatever the hell it was with my then ex-girlfriend, which was, in retrospect, a really stupid move. So, in the brief 30 seconds that this match lasts, Magnum shoulder block, forearm, and then the belly-to-belly coming off the ropes, off an Irish whip, picks up the three counts. So, just kind of your standard Magnum TA squash.
The Jim Crockett Senior Memorial Cup, the most prestigious event of the year. Now, Eastern Airlines has become the official airline of the Cup. Eastern is offering a 50% discount anywhere in the continental USA on round-trip airfare for New Orleans. Call toll-free Monday through Friday, 1-800-468-7022. Remember, caller must request EZ4C-P48. Caller must request EZ4C-P48.
Even though I said I was going to go back and forth between the videos, I just couldn't help myself. Plus, apparently, I have the time for this sort of thing these days. And I noticed that they were running an ad for Eastern Airlines flying to New Orleans for the Crockett Cup, which, very early example of, let's fly in fans from all over the country for this particular event. I don't recall them doing anything like that for Starcade with flights to Greensboro. Of course, I don't know how big the airport actually is. So Eastern Airlines being the sponsor of that, where you have to put in this weird 8-letter number code into whatever your reservation is. I guess you'd be calling the airline at that point in time. It's kind of hard to think of a time where you had to phone the airline to actually book a flight. I mean, I think pretty much my whole life has just kind of been online, at least as I recall, although I remember buying a group of tickets at the airport for Boston to Washington. U.S. Air used to offer something like that. So the whole Eastern Airlines connection finally explains something to me from this next interview, which I've seen before. Dusty Rhodes and Baby Doll. And of course, Baby Doll was rescued from Tully Blanchard. Tully ends up getting the national title from Dusty Rhodes, as I mentioned earlier. Baby Doll, just in looking at through her history, she hated being a babyface because it meant she had to be nice to people, which seems to be the common complaint, that sort of thing. But the interesting thing to me is that Dusty, for whatever reason, is wearing an Eastern Airlines shirt that looks like one of those sort of faux retro things that you could pick up at Target. like something with like a really old logo on it. What's another thing that's kind of funny is he's got like a jacket on and it's blocking the last letter in Eastern Airlines, so it just says Easter on it. And with Easter this Sunday, which you may have forgotten since you've been locked in your house and maybe you haven't looked at a calendar recently. So yeah, Dusty Rhodes in his finest Eastern Airlines shirt. As a matter of fact, it was a promo that I didn't play from the other video with all the local promos where Magnum TA is wearing an Eastern Airlines hat. So clearly they were in bed with each other and sending promotional stuff like, hey, promote the airline. Eastern Airlines was starting to show early signs of trouble. The first flight I ever took as a kid was on Eastern Airlines to Orlando to go to Disney World with my whole family. The biggest thing I remember about it was the fact that my mother smoked on the plane, which is one of those things. It's like, oh yeah. I mean, I'm going to be like in the absolute last generation of people that saw smoking on a domestic flight, since that was outlawed in, I think, 1989 or 1990. But Eastern Airlines, I mean, obviously you haven't heard of them in a long time. And part of it goes back to 1985, where they got into a price war with, you know, airlines like People Express, and which I know was referenced on The Simpsons. But here's a little bit more color on what Eastern Airlines is trying to do to combat that sort of thing, other than appealing to wrestling fans to fly to New Orleans. Starting about 1985, Eastern offered, quote, moonlight specials with passenger seats on overnight flights scheduled for cargo from 30 freight companies. The flights, which operated between midnight and 7 a.m., served 18 cities in the United States, connecting mainly to Houston. Eric Schmidt of the New York Times said the services were a hybrid of late-night red-eye flights and bare-bones People Express approach to service. The holds of the aircraft were reserved for cargo, such as express mail, machine tool parts, and textiles. Because of this, the airline allowed each passenger to take up to two carry-on bags. The airline charged $10 for each checked bag, which was shipped standby. The airline charged between 50 cents and $3 for beverages and snacks. This all sounds very familiar for anybody flying in modern times. Bunny Duck, an Eastern flight attendant, nice name, quoted in the New York Times, said that the passengers on the special flights were a cross-section of families, college kids, illegal aliens, and weirdos from L.A. Well, you know, is there any other kind of person from L.A. is what I have to say about that. Now, oddly, and this is kind of funny to me with Dusty Rhodes wearing the Eastern Airlines shirt, their last day in operation as an airline was January 19th, 1991. The last day that Dusty Rhodes was a full-time competitor in the World Wrestling Federation. Yes, it was the day of the 1991 Royal Rumble. But he's still going strong here. And this is kind of like a meandering promo where he's kind of walking all over the place. I mean, I'm going to cut out the first part where he talks about Jimmy Valiant and how he's going to take care of business against Paul Jones's army. I just kind of focus on... He's in the war with Tully at this point because Baby Doll is there, so that much is obvious. And I had to go back to the regular video because the actual video on the one with all the commercials, it just shows the identification of this channel on the screen while playing the audio of the Dusty promo. So, whatever.
I get thousands of letters, David, every week. Every week. And a lot of them are addressed to Baby Doll. Baby Doll came to Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, and since that day, the power of the revenue-making professional wrestling star Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream, for Jim Crockett Promotions has overwhelmed this country. The prettiest lady on the air. On the air. And Dusty Rhodes, the American Dream. Tully Blanchard, you got out of here a while ago and you said Dusty Rhodes, two-time World Heavyweight Champion. Dusty Rhodes, former World Television Champion. And Dusty Rhodes, former National Heavyweight Champion. You said, Dusty Rhodes, I beat you. What does that make me? That makes you lucky. Woo! And I mean lucky, baby. J.J. Dillon, find the time to put it on the dotted line. Find the time. If it's in San Antonio, Texas, wherever it is, find the time. Tully Blanchard, you belong to me. I got what once belonged to you. I got your soul, your pride, and your whole perseverance in professional wrestling. I am the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes.
I don't care if it was meandering. I mean, at least it was passionate. Although, if I was a true wise ass like Eddie Eldner in the PWI magazines or one of the very, Dave Meltzer, as an example, used to like to call Dusty fat. They're like, well, why is he wearing an airline on his shirt? Wouldn't it be more befitting if he was wearing, oh, I don't know, Michelin for the Michelin Man or Goodyear for the Goodyear blimp? But now that I have that resolve where, yes, okay, it makes sense that he's wearing an Eastern Airlines shirt on TV. Like, I thought it was just for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Dusty just liked the airline or something. So it's nice to know that there was a product tie-in for to get fans to come to New Orleans for the Crockett Cup in 86.
After an absence of 76 years, the return of Halley's Comet creates an atmosphere of excitement and anticipation. Around the country, people wait in line at observatories to get a better look at the comet through powerful telescopes.
Looked like a small piece of cotton, more or less, little dot.
Is it just that fuzzy thing in the middle?
That's it. Just that fuzzy thing.
The only thing there.
Sorry about that, but that's all there is.
I guess it was a little disappointing. There was so much play given to it.
I was reading about Halley's Comet about a week ago, and it was on that week in 1986 that it made its closest approach to Earth, and it was just this little speck in the sky. I mean, I can remember looking up in from like my back porch and, oh, is that it? Is that it? And apparently, in what I read last week, it was apparently the least visible it would be for 2,000 years worth of of approaches that Halley's Comet. It's every 75 or 76 years, somewhere in that ballpark. So there, out of about 22, that was definitely the worst one, the one in the more modern era. And I'm probably never going to see it again because I'd have to live to about 83. And given how much I've drank and smoked in my lifetime and with diseases, you know, ridding society these days, probably not going to get there. So at the end of the Dusty promo, you could hear a little bit of booing, and that was because in the background, the Four Horsemen were making their way out. I mean, we don't get musical entrances in Crockett at this point in time, except for Jimmy Valiant, who gets a boy from New York City, and very few would get anything. The Freebirds, when they would show up in 87 after the UWF merger, I guess they would get Bad Street. But Flair, Arn and Tully Blanchard are going to be taking on George South, Gene Ligon, and the Italian Stallion, which is, all right, you get the Four Horsemen, the best three out of the Four Horsemen. Sorry, Ole, but you're the shits, as you like to say. And the all-star enhancement team. I mean, maybe Gene Ligon doesn't make that list, or maybe you think Italian Stallion is a little bit above that level, but what a crew that is. And it's kind of uncommon to see Ric Flair in this spot. I think I've commented in the past, it's always weird seeing Flair like working the apron in a tag match. I think I must have been talking about that for that Clash 23 match where it's him and Arn against the Hollywood Blondes. It's just feels unusual. You watch all these Ric Flair singles matches where he's the world champion defending in this long match, and then you see him just standing on the apron during a tag match. Also, you don't see Flair too often on television, but you certainly see him more than Hulk Hogan, as I spoke about a couple of weeks ago. Hogan on TV in 86 in a match is very, very rare, even in a tag team match. So Flair, Arn Anderson, and Tully Blanchard are all singles champions this time. Flair, of course, the world champion. Arn is TV champion. And Tully, as we established earlier, is the national champion. So it's pretty cool to see three guys wearing three different belts go into the ring. It's got a little bit more cachet than, like, Flair and the tag team champions because, you know, it's three different things. As Tully starts out with the Italian Stallion, offers a handshake to him, and then pulls away, tries to dope slap Stallion, who ducks out of the way of that. Now, I can just remember the last time Italian Stallion was covered on Greetings from Allentown, it was a match called by Jim Ross, where he was basically calling him a friggin' idiot the entire time. Like, he's a dumb guy. He managed to say that in about three different ways. So a side headlock by the Stallion, which Tully escapes, but then he ends up in the corner of the Horseman. Then he dropped toe hold by Tully, tagged to Arn, but he gets his arm grabbed by the Stallion, so he turns it around on him. And then Gene Ligon is in there. He gets caught in the wrong part of town, as Gorilla Monsoon would say. Flair is in there, hits that beautiful-looking knee drop that he would do. Tags out to Tully, and they get a blow exchange. Oh, wait, that's a bad choice of phrase that I wrote in my notes there. I mean, given what Tully Blanchard was into in the 1980s. It was an exchange of strikes, let's say, rather than an exchange of blow, because in the 80s that meant something completely different. But he escapes, Ligon does, and he goes through Tully's legs to the other side of the ring and tags George South into the match, hits some right hands, but then off an Irish whip, misses on a drop kick. Now it is time to go to school with Double A, who comes in there, and of course the Irish whip, and a rather deliberate spine buster. Like he really was targeting and wanted to lay it in. I'm giving it an 8.3 out of 10. Yes, I'll actually go to the tenths place. I won't just round it by halves. And Flair tags in as well, give him a little bit of shine, double underhook suplex, goes to the pin, only gets a two count, which kind of interesting, but we need to get a little bit more shine there. Also, it may have something to do with Flair. He has a lot of respect for George South. In fact, he has said in interviews that he was his favorite enhancement guy to work with. There's a Flair George South match from June of 85 that is out there on YouTube, runs about 4 or 5 minutes. And Flair, in this setting, one thing I like is you get to see more of his arsenal than in the Luger and Sting series, and later in the 80s, you don't see him expand his offense. He's basically taking a beating for much of that. He locks in an abdominal stretch, which I don't know if I've ever seen Ric Flair do an abdominal stretch, but he turns it into a roll-up, which made me mad because it just made me think of B. Brian Blair's finisher in 84 WWF and how he just bores the crap out of me and how I don't like him. But fortunately, South was kind of in the ropes, and now all six men are in because it was sort of near the horseman corner. And Stallion gets stuck in a one-on-three situation as the other two guys got thrown out of the ring. And then Stallion, when they try to toss him through the ropes, because you can't do over the top rope because that's a DQ, Stallion just kind of hits the ropes awkwardly and just sort of stops. So I guess he's just was not in the mood to be taking that bump. So we normalize back to Flair and George South, and we get a tag into Arn, who an Irish whip and hits the Ted DiBiase Buzz Sawyer power slam. Apparently Arn is out to break all the scales today. I give that one an 8.5 out of 10. Solid job by Arn Anderson. Apparently just does all his best stuff off Irish whips, which is why he would have been great in the 90s, late 90s, if he had wrestled a little bit more. And Tully Blanchard comes in. He just sort of drops an elbow. I kind of wonder what the point of that was, but he's just going to tag out to Flair, locks in the figure four. And as he's got that in, we get all guys in the ring, and everybody hits their finisher on the enhancements. Arn hits the gourd buster on Gene Ligon on the near side of the ring. Flair's got South in the figure four in the center. That's the formal legal guys in the match. And Tully, you can barely see it in the background, but he gets the Italian Stallion up for the slingshot suplex. So pretty cool to see all these guys in the ring together, I have to admit. It's sort of like, as I mentioned earlier, like Dangerous Alliance six-man matches from early 1992. Now, I'm sure that there are more of these, and I'll come across them at some point, because the Crockett stuff from this era is very watchable, and I'm looking for watchable stuff at this point in my life. And that is where my original video cuts off. But I think they just went back to David Crockett on the real one. He's just like, see you next time on The Best, or something awkward. So that'll do it for NWA Worldwide for April 5th, 1986. Elsewhere in the land of podcasts, my good friends on the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Marano and Michael Quinn, they take a look in episode 171 at the Honky Tonk Man and also do a review at the end of the episode, as they do, of Action Zone WWF from April 16th, 1995. That sucker's got a Hunter Hearst Helmsley vignette in it when he's doing the British accent. I don't know how to translate that into a British accent, so I'm not even going to attempt that. And on the sportscasters with my good pal Steve Bennett and partner on the Adams Division podcast, he's got Adnan Virk talking NFL draft, which is going to be a very different experience this year. It's going to be like a giant Zoom meeting where they're all sitting there, which for the players involved, I mean, I'm not as hard on Roger Goodell because I'm staring at an autographed football that was given to me that says, Pete, Merry Christmas, Roger Goodell. But to go to New York or wherever they're holding the draft, I know they're moving it around, it's just so utterly pointless where you put on the hat and you hug the commissioner, and I don't know. Steve also has on Andy Green, who's got a book out on The Office, which would be The Office television show, and try to translate that program into what's going on right now. It's pretty much impossible. I'm sure they could do something goofy with Dwight and say, hey, you can all quarantine at Shroot Farms because, you know, nobody comes here or something like that. I don't know. Just trying to... Yeah, that show has now been off the air for 7 years, and I gotta say, it certainly had some staying power. One that I forgot to plug, in part because I did not know when that show was going to drop, as it was recorded last week, is Talkin' Pop Live. I appeared early in the episode that just dropped yesterday, as a matter of fact, and I'm doling out relationship advice like I'm Dr. Drew, which I referenced in the episode, and throwing a little cheap shot at Drew for some of his... Well, let's just say this has not been the best time for celebrity doctors, whether it be Drew, Oz, or whoever, really. Dr. Oz is particularly bad. That guy's been a hack from day one. So do check that out. Talkin' Pop. It's on the Jenny Position feed with Jennifer Smith and Tim Capel. I don't know why I'm talking like this, because one of the things I got a problem with right now is I had a filling redone at the end of January. Actually, it was in February. Middle of February. And a piece of it is already broken off. So I have like half of my back molar back there, and I'm back in the position I was from like November and December, when I was pretty much couldn't eat anything because of my gallbladder. But right now I can actually eat stuff, but it's wildly uncomfortable when you have half a tooth that's not even there. So with that in mind, I can sneak in a quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Although I'm not sure how short this is actually going to be, because I'm probably going to look at the YouTube comments from both videos, and I think between them there's about 50. As always, these are actual YouTube comments left by what I can only presume are actual users, and hopefully some of the names are fairly easy to read for a change. Mindless Droid says, these were the days the belts looked better, the promos were better, the squash matches were even entertaining, and I dare say even David Crockett was better in an odd sort of way. So another defender of David Crockett and his infectious enthusiasm. Greg for Fun says, NWA had a couple shows on Saturdays back in the day, didn't they? Anyone know who won those chain matches? Ha ha. Well, I didn't bother to look up, but of course the best of seven between Nikita and Magnum was won by Nikita in the odd pattern that you generally never see in a best of seven in baseball or basketball or even hockey, where one team wins the first three games, that would be Nikita, then the other team wins the next three games, that's Magnum, and then Nikita prevails in game seven. You don't see that very often in sports. There might have been a Dallas-Portland series that went like that at some point. I have this vague recollection, and I don't know why I commit stupid crap like that to memory. Glenn Woolery says, now this is wrestling. WWE now sucks. I'd rather watch the NWA wrestling. It will never be the same. Well, there is NWA wrestling out there. I mean, it's just that Billy Corgan's in charge of it. And I guess he posted a Houston 1980 show, which that kind of appears on my radar. I'm like, maybe I should do that one. But I'd kind of like a few more to go out there so I can kind of pick amongst the various things. Daryl Bell says, I love the part when Magnum TA hung Nikita with the chain, LMAO, not at 9:30. That's where the money was made. Yes, well, Magnum was a badass, and that's why he was very, very popular and just incredibly over with the crowds. Joseph Saylor says Ric Flair at the very apex of his game here. Perfect hair, brand new $35,000 belt in his best row. And as I mentioned before, a daughter being born on the day that this show aired. Nolan Walls says Rocky King is the man. I trained with him some and wrestled him in Atlanta. He still looks like 1M. Now that would mean $1 million. So that comment was left 4 months ago. So I, you know, fairly recent. Daryl Bell also says, love to see the Horsemen in that six-man tag team match where the title's on the line. No, this is not like that weird In Your House where we're putting up singles titles against... No, they're not doing that. Xavier Owens says, Nikita Koloff wasn't even Russian, but he had me fooled for decades. Yeah, Nikita had this habit, apparently, behind the scenes of even kayfabing it in front of his co-workers, which kind of pissed some people off, but I give him credit for buying into his gimmick that much, where there was like no line of separation between where the real guy ended and where the Nikita Koloff character began. AJ313 said, I went down the line, gave everyone a like. My mother died in 1985. A coworker had tickets for big time wrestling in Detroit. I went, and for 2 hours I forgot about my mother and I cheered for 2 hours. Came home and cried for 2 days. Thanks for this. Okay, well that kind of bums me out, and I really didn't need that at this particular point in time. Bert from Markkinen says, I remember, that's a great name because it's all one word, from Markkinen. I remember this. Man, 1985 was a crazy year in Baltimore. This was like the solace for a lot of kids growing up there. We are Mid-Atlantic Wrestling and Worldwide Kids. That's what we were coming up. Was awesome. And Baltimore had all the stuff because they were definitely on that borderline between where WWF ruled and where Crockett ruled. Kind of like that territory where it was mixed all the way up to Philadelphia because Crockett was running shows up there as well. Don Guabisimo says, great memories. The NWA was the real deal. These angles were intense. I hated this show was only an hour, but they packed a lot into them. Those crowds popped huge. They must have changed the show opening music not long after this. Yeah, it went to a less funky and less disco-y beat afterwards. Jonathan Turbide says, great promo by the champ. Never seen that one before. I have no idea how Rick was able to keep his composure when that annoying Mark, David Crockett, was trying to speak over him at the beginning. Gosh, he was awful. So I guess that's one vote for Dave against David Crockett. Seems to be a very divisive character. Wayne P117 says, Magnum was one of the biggest and fastest rising stars. He was set to become one of the best sported scenes since Ricky Steamboat, but a terrible accident and decision ruined his career. I don't know what he means by decision or what he's insinuating. He was driving too fast, yes, but Magnum was not drunk at the time of the accident, if that is what he is trying to get at on that. And finally, Kenneth Malone says, Slick Rick is still styling and profiling as a wrestling legend and a Hall of Famer. The Rock and Roll Express looked like a couple of tire changers from Cooter's Garage on the Dukes of Hazzard. Well, I don't know about that. They were the NWA Tag Team Champions within the last several months. I don't know if it was in calendar year 2020, but they certainly are still in the picture despite their advanced age. That'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Looking through stuff that I could do for next week, I'm thinking maybe do one with a hair angle or something. I mean, that's the kind of stuff that usually gets my attention. I mean, it would be bad news if I picked like an AWA show from 1980 or something where like it's just wrestling matches and nothing happens, because I would just be bored out of my skull and there might not be a podcast anymore. Or I could just talk about, you know, anything else like on GFA Live. Time will tell if I feel up to doing one of those this weekend, but do be on the lookout for that on social media at GF Allentown Pod. And that's where I'll probably put up next Wednesday what the next show, if there is one, is going to be. I mean, I don't know. I just feel locked up or whatever. But what you can do for me that'll definitely get me going and make me feel good is leave a review for Greetings from Allentown on iTunes, Apple Music, Apple Podcasts, whatever the hell it's called, or wherever fine podcast reviews are accepted. provides what is known as social proof that you're listening to and enjoying this podcast. It proves that, like, yes, you have actually listened to this program and you are actually willing to make the effort to comment on it alongside a five-star, which is always appreciated. And I thank you so much for listening. And do tune in next time for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.